At what test model do we say, okay, now it's time for a resolution, or do we go ahead and go forward? And I think that's what we're trying to work on.
U.S. defensive missiles prove their ability. It's Thursday, June 1st. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, new Chinese and Russian planes begin flight. Kenya has a new Chinese train. Taiwan shows off new computer technology, giving up tobacco and solar power for refugees. We power up right now on VOA Asia. Days after the latest North Korean missile test, the United States has successfully conducted its own test involving a simulated attack by an intercontinental ballistic missile. VOA's Jay Susimanoni reports U.S. officials call the drill a critical milestone in U.S. defense.
It was the first of its kind, a defensive drill simulating a nuclear missile attack on the United States. The U.S. military launched an intercontinental ballistic missile from the Marshall Islands, then fired a second missile from an Air Force base in California. The goal? To shoot down the Mach warhead over the Pacific Ocean. And it worked. The second missile intercepted the first, destroying it in mid-flight over the ocean. The drill comes amid increased tensions with North Korea over its nuclear program. The rogue state has ramped up the pace of its missile tests in recent weeks, despite condemnation from the UN and many world leaders.
Nothing is changing North Korea's actions. And so it's regrouping and saying, okay, what are we going to do if this is going to happen every other day?
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley adds that the U.S. and Pyongyang's closest ally, China, are negotiating further Security Council actions on North Korea.
At what point do we do the resolution is kind of the discussions we're having now. Is at what test model do we say, okay, now it's time for a resolution, or do we go ahead and go forward? And I think that's what we're trying to work on.
Haley says the Trump administration believes China is using back-channel networking with North Korea to try to stop the nuclear testing. Jesus Semeoni, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Navy officials tell VOA two U.S. aircraft carriers have started military exercises together in the Sea of Japan. Navy spokesman Lieutenant Lauren Terry said the USS Carl Vinson Strike Group and USS Ronald Reagan Strike Group are conducting routine operations in the Western Pacific. Officials said the carriers, along with the ships and aircraft assigned to each, began dual operations in international waters within the sea Wednesday. Spokesman Terry said the multi-day, multi-carrier exercises provide, quote, combatant commanders with significant operational flexibility should these forces be called on in response to regional situations. The dual carrier operations also mark the end of the USS Vinson Strike Group's current tour in the Western Pacific. American ships and aircraft routinely operate in international waters throughout the Western Pacific, which includes waters surrounding the Korean Peninsula. U.S. Pacific Command said the short-range ballistic missile North Korea launched on May 28th posed no threat to North America, adding that the U.S. military stands behind its, quote, ironclad commitment to the security of our allies in the Republic of Korea and Japan. We invite you to read more on this developing story by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Myanmar to probe video that appears to show soldiers beating people. Crackdowns have Indonesian gay community on edge. USS Vinson, USS Reagan carrier strike groups conduct dual exercises in Sea of Japan. China postpones portion of cybersecurity law. Senate Democrats ask Trump for answers on China trademarks. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. We continue with VOA Asia. A new generation of Russian commercial aircraft took to the skies over Siberia on Sunday with a maiden flight of the Irkut Corporation's MC-21 medium-range passenger plane. It comes just 3 weeks after China flew its new C-919 passenger jet. Both represent potential competition for commercial aviation giants Airbus of Europe and Boeing of the United States. The MC-21, Russia's first commercial aircraft since the collapse of the Soviet Union, is designed to replace the country's aging fleet of Tupolev aircraft. The plane flew off from the Irkutsk aviation plant on a flight lasting 30 minutes at an altitude of 1,000 meters and a speed of 300 kilometers per hour. The MC-21-300 can carry up to 211 passengers. It has a range of 6,000 kilometers, while a variant, the MC-21-200, can carry up to 165 passengers. The Aviation Analysis Wing blog said the plane features the first polymer composite wing that reduces weight and it's more fuel efficient, and the aircraft will cut operational costs up to 15%. Jeffrey Thomas is editor of the AirlineRatings.com website, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty both Russia and China face a big question mark as they seek to enter the highly competitive commercial aircraft market.
The big issue for both Russia and China is to convince the airlines of the world that they can support these aircraft. So you've got two issues, the reliability of them in service and the support, which that after-sales support must go on for 20, 30, 40 years. Now, Boeing and Airbus have extraordinary reputations when it comes to after-sales support, and that's the most critical thing here. And also, the particular market segment that these aeroplanes are pitched at is the short haul, quick turnaround. I mean, a 737 and A320 aircraft are the backbone of the world's aviation system. And most airlines these days, particularly the low-cost airlines, have turnarounds of only 30 minutes at airports. And that requires a very high degree of reliability. And this is going to be the real acid test for both the Russian aircraft and for the Chinese one that's pitched at this market, is to prove that they've got the reliability of their competitors, the 737 and the A320.
Western aviation analysts expressed surprise at the flight's brevity on Sunday. Relatively low altitude, just about 30 minutes in the air at an altitude about 1,000 meters, traveling at about 300 kilometers per hour. One source called it a genteel flight. What do you make of that?
It's hard to work out exactly what that was all about. And indeed, typically a first flight of, say, an Airbus or a Boeing airplane, it'll be 3, 4, 5 hours long. It'll typically climb to cruising altitude in some cases. So, yes, it's certainly a very timid first flight. It's unclear as to why it was so. It's most unusual and doesn't really give you a great tick-the-box sort of feeling about the aeroplane. I'm sure there's a good reason for it, but that's yet to be divulged.
Irkut Corporation, the manufacturer of the aircraft, said it had 175 firm orders for the aircraft.
Yes, they do, and same with the Chinese one. However, these orders are from a variety of countries where the reliability issue is not as key as it is, say, for a JetBlue operation or a Southwest operation in the United States or a Ryanair in the United Kingdom.
The debut of the MC-21 comes as Russian flagship carrier Aeroflot has improved its overall performance, winning a fourth star from the independent rating website Skytrax. Jeffrey Thomas's website said the airline has been given a 7-star rating for safety, although with a fleet dominated by Airbus and Boeing aircraft. Happening now in Asia, a massive truck bomb exploded early Wednesday in the diplomatic section of Afghanistan's capital, killing at least 90 people, wounding more than 300 others. The bombing happened in an area not far from the German embassy. Stay up to date. Watch VOA 60 online. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always happy to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thank you so much for listening today. China's ambitious plan to create a modern Silk Road trading community called Belt and Road, which stretches across Asia and into Europe and Africa, is continuing, and China's been developing massive infrastructure projects in Africa, not only to help the nations there, but to also help facilitate Chinese interests as its companies seek natural resources to fuel the massive Chinese economy. Just opened in Kenya is the Madaraka Express, which carried distinguished passengers on its maiden journey from a gleaming new terminal in Mombasa. Its final destination was Nairobi. Kenya President Uhuru Kenyatta praised the new rail line as a key cornerstone of Kenya's transformation to an industrialized, prosperous middle-income country. Not everyone agrees, however, that the expensive Chinese-funded train will boost Kenya's economy. VOA East Africa correspondent Jill Craig discusses these issues with Kim Lewis.
So the significance of this new railway is that it's the country's largest infrastructure project since independence. It cost approximately $3.3 billion, and the plan is to actually link it from Mombasa to Uganda and then potentially beyond to Rwanda. This really represents quite a shift in, I guess, policy, you could say, for Kenya's leadership. President Kenyatta has put quite a large emphasis upon infrastructure projects in Kenya, and we've seen this a few times before. He's also prioritized roads, pipelines, oil development, and even geothermal power. This is definitely on the Kenyatta government's priorities list.
Now, this was a collaboration with the Chinese, and I understand it was done through a loan that Kenya will have to pay back. So how is that going to work out?
The plan, as I understand it, is that the Chinese government, first of all, they funded about 90% of the railway project through the government-owned Export-Import Bank of China, and Kenya's government provided, I think, about 10% of the overall cost. This is a massive project. Something worth mentioning is that the cost represents about 5% of Kenya's overall GDP. That has also drawn some criticism from skeptics who say you've spent way too much on this project, and we don't know for sure that the outcome is going to pay for what we put into it. Others, more optimistically, say that they believe that this is really going to help Kenya's economy. It's going to boost the economy of East Africa, and that overall it's going to help people, sort of the ordinary Kenyans. It will actually help them in the long run.
Were any local Kenyans used in building the rail system?
Yes. And in the beginning, that was quite a controversy because people did not think that they would be used. But the China Road and Bridge Company did employ about 20,000 local workers. So that sort of appeased some people, I should say. Another issue that has been brought up several times throughout this building process is that people are concerned about the wildlife. Kenya is known for its wildlife. The concern was that the new railway would disrupt migration patterns and whatnot in the area that the railway would go through. But the Chinese did make some concessions. They did allow for underpasses to be built for wildlife to cross, I know, at least a section of a railway near Tsavo National Park. But again, that doesn't mean that everyone's happy.
I understand this particular train is the express from Mombasa to Nairobi. So is it something that people will be able to afford to travel back and forth?
Yes, that's the plan. In the old days, it would cost approximately $12 for someone to take the bus from Nairobi to Mombasa and vice versa. The Kenyatta government today announced that it will cost Kenyans about the equivalent of $7 to travel between Nairobi and Mombasa. It makes it more affordable. Another big draw is that the time that it will take to actually travel between the two cities will be significantly reduced. So currently, taking the two-lane highway that goes between Nairobi and Mombasa, it takes about, if you're lucky, around 10 hours, but it could be even longer than that by bus. Now the plan is that trip will take about 4 hours. For Kenyans, it represents quite a difference in both price and also in time spent in transport.
Considering the upcoming election in August, what is the significance of the timing of this new system?
The timing of this railway launch has been debated quite heavily on social media, in the newspapers, and that's because the elections are coming up on August 8th, and this railway was not supposed to be launched until December of this year. So it was actually delivered several months ahead of schedule, and people believe that there is significance in this, given that the Kenyatta government and his ruling Jubilee Party want to sort of showcase what they've done to the country in advance of the upcoming elections. It should be mentioned that the opposition's candidate for president, Mr. Raila Odinga, has said that although he's not against these sorts of massive infrastructure projects, should his party become the ruling party come August, he will plan on spending more of his effort in helping Kenyans access basic needs such as health care, education, you know, livelihood, helping the youth with getting jobs. So he's going to focus more on those sorts of policies versus these massive infrastructure project.
VOA East Africa correspondent Jill Craig speaking from Nairobi with VOA's Kim Lewis. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte denounced Chelsea Clinton for her criticism of remarks he made last week about rape. Duterte said he was simply being sarcastic in a speech aimed to show his full support for soldiers enforcing martial law in the southern Philippines. VOA Asia Facebook has all the big stories. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, computer manufacturer Acer was riding two major themes in Taiwan at the annual Computex Taipei. That's Asia's largest tech show. Virtual reality, often abbreviated to VR, and artificial intelligence, or AI, were on full display inside the sprawling Acer stall. The staff displayed a laptop computer that's ready for virtual reality play, yet thinner than most personal computers. And at the same exhibition, the Taiwanese tech hardware maker showed how its internet cloud uses artificial intelligence to predict what customers will do when shopping and allow the shop to make decisions accordingly. Demand from gamers is a lucrative market of people willing to pay more than $10,000 for a PC. That's driving the VR side. Vincent Lin, senior director of Acer's global product marketing, says it's inspiring his company and its peers to install new lines of processors that support immersive 3D play with headgear and hand controls.
You can see that the company is moving into a very gaming-centric VR new experience innovation. Not all gaming notebooks or not all notebooks are VR-ready. There are certain requirements needed to be VR-ready. VR, certainly, it's a growth area. It's supposed to like grow five times or something within the next 3 years.
Silicon Valley investment advisory firm DigiCapital forecasts a surge in global revenue from $20 billion this year to $108 billion in 2021 in virtual reality technology and similar technology known as augmented reality. The anticipation of growth inspired 60 Computex exhibitors to show games, gear, or PCs that support virtual reality. The technology that first popped into public view back in the 1980s is normally aimed at computer gamers, but scientific researchers have also found that VR is great for augmented reality to model processes that they can't duplicate in real life. Near Acer's stall, Computex visitors don thick black head-mounted goggles to race cars or fire at things. And developers were excited about NVIDIA's newly announced graphics processors that are designed to make PCs thinner and quieter. They also noticed the seventh update of Intel's Core i5 processor, which stands to make PCs faster. At one stall, Hong Kong developer Zotac showed off backpacks that can hold a gamer's VR hardware system to prevent any tripping over wires. Zotac product marketer Wu Lai says that might happen to somebody immersed in a 3D scenario and not able to see the real floor.
Right now, because of the way that the virtual reality equipment is made, you're tethered to a system. That means you have to worry about tripping over cables, wrapping around yourself as well. Without VR Go Backpack, that removes those barriers, so you're more free to experience VR the way it's supposed to be experienced.
Artificial intelligence also made its way into the show, where about 1,600 exhibitors occupied more than 5,000 booths as companies tested a relatively new technology that teaches computers to make decisions based on patterns they detect through analysis of user commands. Voice-activated assistants on mobile phones used artificial intelligence by searching the phone for requested information, even sending commands across apps to get their answers. It's a huge market, growing at a rate of 63% from 2016 to 2022, and forecasts by the research firm Markets and Markets predict the artificial intelligence market should be worth over $16 billion 5 years from now. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for using his digital electronics to send us this story. Developing at this hour in Asia, a Malaysia Airlines flight to Kuala Lumpur safely landed in Melbourne from where it took off after a passenger attempted to enter the cockpit late Wednesday. This disruptive passenger, a Sri Lankan national, was apparently drunk and falsely claiming to have a bomb. You'll find the top stories every day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, smoking, as you probably know, is quite prevalent across Asia, and the United Nations warns more than 7 million people die prematurely every year from tobacco-related causes. Tobacco, a costly drain on national economies. And for World No Tobacco Day, which comes at the end of May every year, the World Health Organization has been urging governments to implement strong tobacco control measures. As we hear from Lisa Schlein in Geneva, it's for the health of their people and economies.
The World Health Organization calls tobacco a threat to development. Besides killing millions of people annually, WHO says tobacco costs the world economy $1.4 trillion a year, or 1.8% of gross domestic product. Andrew Black is with the WHO Framework Convention on Tobacco Control Secretariat. He says millions of people who smoke suffer from a wide range of tobacco-related diseases and morbidity, including blindness, amputation, impotence, and poor oral health. He says by 2030, around 80% of the world's tobacco-related mortality will be in low- and middle-income countries.
High rates of tobacco use being promoted by aggressive strategies from the tobacco industry are projected to lead to a doubling of the number of tobacco-related deaths in low- and middle-income countries between 2010 and 2030.
For the first time ever, WHO and the UN Development Program have released a report showing the impact of tobacco on the environment. Vinayak Prasad, the program manager of the Tobacco Free Initiative, says the data reveals some disturbing results.
Evidence is really astounding as to how tobacco is extremely dangerous and harming the environment, causing deforestation and a lot of other challenges.
For example, the report notes tobacco waste contains more than 7,000 toxic chemicals that poison the environment, including carcinogens. It notes cigarette butts account for 30 to 40% of all items collected in coastal and urban cleanups. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Finding safety, shelter, sanitation, food, and water are all challenges that refugees anywhere in the world face. VOA's Faith Lapidus tells us now solar power is helping to make life easier in Jordan for the 20,000 Syrian refugees at a camp that once had no reliable source of electricity.
Azraq is the second largest Syrian refugee camp in Jordan. Since it opened more than 2 years ago, the camp residents have lived without reliable access to electricity. The newly inaugurated solar plant, funded by the IKEA Foundation, will change that.
It means the world to refugees that obviously are here in the camp that didn't have access to electricity in a dependable way. It means lighting for safety, for protection at night, for some cool in terms of a fan on a hot summer's day, or some heat in the winter during the cold months.
Farhan Nazal says having reliable power means freedom.
Before electricity, we could not come and go as we please. At sunset, we would be confined to our homes. Now that we have electricity, we can go to our neighbor's house, enjoy the evening, or our neighbors can come over. It is more enjoyable, we have fun, and are happier.
And kids can watch TV, although that's not the benefit that's most important to Anas Ahmed.
To begin with, students, for example, my children can now study with lights on. Secondly, it was very hot in the caravan. Now I have a fan. We also have a fridge now, so we have cool water and can preserve our food, and a washing machine. I previously had to transfer water, and my wife would wash clothes by hand. It's a lot easier for her now.
The plant's construction has also provided work opportunities for some 50 refugees who were trained and employed to build and set up the solar panels. They now have skills to maintain and operate the plant and apply them elsewhere to find work outside the refugee camp. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
VOA Asia says hello to all of our listeners in the Philippines. Listening to DZUP 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines in Diliman. Thanks so much. Thanks, too, to our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon, managing editor Diane Gao, David Bird, and Ali Ogden on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.